This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action with host Arman Shrocki. Each week, Arman will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution for SaaS companies on AWS. The tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curve.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. I have a special guest this week, Lee Blakemore with IntraHive. Lee, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself and about your company?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you, Ahmed. Thank you for the opportunity. So, my name is Lee Blakemore. I'm the CEO of an exciting company called IntraHive. And about myself, I'm a career sort of technology sales leader, business leader, and now CEO. I spent my entire career in technology, and ranging from being sort of a sales guy, if you will, back in the day, and sort of working my way up through organizations. And over the course of my 30 years of doing this, I've both worked at, you know, a startup in the dot-com era, if you're old enough to remember that, where I was employee number 5 or 6. And then to the other extreme, I was acquired into IBM and spent 9 years at IBM, where there was 400,000 employees. And so kind of worked in both spectrums and spent the last 20 some years of my career working in a global scenario. And that's something that I really enjoy as well. So, and I live just outside of Chicago with my wife and 2 college age daughters.
Fantastic. So one of the things that matter, doesn't matter the size of the company, as big as IBM or as small as a 5 or 10 people company, it matters most is the team. Of course, if you don't have a good team, doesn't matter what else you have. And if you have a great team, most often they can figure out, you know, how it works. You know, they can, you know, take the right course of action and everything will change for the good every day. What is your take based on your experience on this matter that you have worked with large and small companies and you have enough experience on the customer facing roles as well?
Yeah, you raise a great point. It's all about the people. And it's interesting, we spend our time in technology and probably other industries. You spend a lot of your time talking about the product or the direction of the industry, and that's reason. But really, the secret to success is the people of the team, both the quality and the skills, as well as then sort of the culture and the mindsets. And I've seen this countless times over my career, whether, you know, when I was at IBM or other places, and you'd go to one country and you'd sit down and you'd do a business review with the team, and there's all sorts of challenges and issues or whatever. And then you go to the next country the next day and, you know, there's no challenges. And, you know, it's the same product, the same competitors, same industry, same market. You know, the difference was, frankly, the team. And what you find over the years, frankly, is if the quality team sort of makes issues kind of go away. And so my focus, certainly over the last many years of my career, has been focusing on getting the right group of folks together and then ensuring they have the right culture and the right mindsets and that they're in an environment where they can be successful. And I find that if you do that, a lot of the other issues sort of just melt away, frankly.
Fantastic. And from your perspective, what is the kind of relationship between having the right data in the organization, having a data-oriented culture in the company, that people make decision upon data more often, and the fact that you are really counting on people and the culture to be the main asset for the success of the company?
Yeah, that's a great question, because on the one hand, you know, usually when you talk about peoples and teams, you also then talk about sort of autonomy and people having being empowered to make decisions, which is great. But if you don't have sort of a foundational level of data that you're operating from, then you can end up with people going in multiple different directions, and sometimes that can be sub-optimized. And so it's really the combination of having foundational set of data, and you as an organization need to come up with a definition of sort of what is foundational, what are the key data points or attributes or elements that you need. And then you need to ensure that you've figured out how you're going to collect that data, maintain that data, interpret that data. What's that whole process? What's the governance system around the data? And once you have that as sort of a foundation level, then you've created the opportunity for teams to sort of work from a common set of data, looking at a common picture, and then going and using some of their skills and personal attributes to go sort of be successful. But it's really that combination of a solid data foundation, then as well with a team that can go be successful.
With regard to the company IntraHive, if I understand correctly, and please correct me if I'm inaccurate about that, but a lot of work that you guys do is about really building data around data in the right way that define the metadata, define the data itself to be understood well across the organization in a unified way, and then bringing all of the customer-related data into that well-defined data structure that now can be most useful. Can you expand a little bit upon that? Who are the people that you mostly, you know, talk to, sell to, market to, and what is the main advantage of such a technology?
Yeah, you bet. So IntraHive is about 11-year-old company, actually, and we came into being to basically answer the basic question of who knows who. So inside, you know, large organizations that sell to other large organizations, people that are on the revenue generating side of the organization, they're always thinking or asking the question, hey, does anybody know somebody that works at fill in the blank? And that's been a fundamental kind of question that people on the revenue generating side of organizations have been sort of wrestling with and answering, you know, for years. And with, you know, the onset of CRM and other sort of platforms and tools, we kind of felt like we had the right approach as an industry. Now we have a CRM system. We can put all this data into the CRM. And so now if I, as a sales individual trying to get my foot in the door at a certain company, I should be able to go into my CRM system and find that information. And the challenge is that CRM systems still basically require or rely upon data to be manually entered into them. And so we try to make all these data-driven decisions this week, like we just mentioned. But yet, in a CRM system, most of the data actually is still, you know, typed in, if you will. And in fact, you look at a modern sort of corporate enterprise, it's one of the few areas or an enterprise landscape where data is still kind of manually entered. And so we've gotten into this point where, on the one hand, we're used to sort of making data-driven decisions. We're used to having access to technology and all these great platforms that we all rely upon. Now we're layering on top of that, you know, AI and multi-link, you know, MLL, et cetera. But the core of all that requires good quality data, and a CRM system still, frankly, you know, relies on manual entry. So what IntraHive does is we actually take all your contacts, take all your information from your email systems, from your calendar systems, et cetera. We pull that out into what we call your hive, hence the name IntraHive, like a beehive. And then we actually enrich that data, because oftentimes you don't have all of the attributes that you may want. You may have a person's name, maybe their job title, but you don't have the other six or seven data fields that you'd like to have. So we then go through our sort of network of partners and other sort of services we sort of bundle into our kind of our core offering. We basically enrich that data, enrich the data in your hive, and then we put it back, then we put it into your CRM for you. So now you actually have a very robust, comprehensive set of data in your CRM that you can then leverage to go answer all these basic questions. And then we don't just do that once, but then we stay synced. And so we're continuously updating. And as people in your customer base or prospect base change roles, change companies, we're collecting that data. And so that you have not only do you have a comprehensive set of data in your CRM system, but it's accurate and it's complete. On top of that, we're actually building out a whole set of capabilities so that you can actually start doing the questions around not only just who knows who, but then what is my relationship score? you know, in this day and age, we all, for instance, have lots of LinkedIn contacts, but I don't know about you, but you know, I might have 5,000 LinkedIn contacts, but you know, I don't know all of them that well. And so this sort of the connection is no longer sufficient. And really what you want to do is you want to start understanding kind of the, what's the relationship strength, if you will, because no, it used to be 10 years ago, does anybody know somebody? But now with all these sort of false connections, if you will, it may appear like they know them, but we don't know how well they know them. So now it's who knows who well. And then as a business leader, what you're really trying to do is correlate this information between business that you're either forecasting or committing or trying to generate and correspond that to where you have relationships that are frankly, you know, strong or strengthening. Or maybe you want to find out business that you feel pretty good about, your relationship store when your organization may be going down, maybe declining. That's a problem, right? So really for us, it's about first having this robust data set that is super important. But then we find there's a bit of a kind of a maturity model that happens. Once you have the data, then you want to make sure you have complete data. Then when you have a complete data, then you want to have sort of analysis on top of the data. You want to leverage AI and some other sort of capabilities. And so it's sort of you work your way up to sort of the spot where then you have the sort of relationship intelligence that we talk about. So for us, yes, it's the core offering is around collecting data, providing robust data that can be leveraged in a CRM. But then once you have that data, taking you on the journey towards having relationship intelligence.
Yeah, very good point on LinkedIn, by the way, because I always think that LinkedIn, as you said, is just getting so massive from number of connections and everything that you almost need a LinkedIn management system now that sits on top of LinkedIn.
Yeah. It's you know, I tried to, for a while there, I tried to be, I don't know, not discreet, but I don't know the right word. I tried to be sort of, I would read when people would ask for a connection and say, well, do I know this person? And maybe I'm not going to accept because I don't want to accept. But now I guess it's so many. I'm sure you're the same. You just, and your my LinkedIn connections are exploding and they almost sort of become less valuable, frankly.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct. I don't know exactly what is the remedy on for that kind of, but definitely there would be solutions either coming from LinkedIn or from third parties, because that's something that I have seen everyone struggle with at the moment. That, as you said, used to be the connections, real connections. And now it's a combination of automated connections and, you know, the ones that are actually, you have more insight into it and you have the real relationship behind it. Now going back to really the SaaS people culture of the companies, from your perspective, you have worked on the sales front, you have worked with smaller and bigger companies. What would you do differently now if you wanted to join some of those startups versus what you did at the earlier days of your career when you joined them?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'd say a couple of things. One is, you know, business sort of goes through fads, if you will. But usually at the end of those fads or those arcs, it gets down to core business fundamentals. Does the company you're running, developing, creating, is it profitable and is revenue growing? And if it's not profitable, is it on a path to profitability? And early times in fads around companies, the focus is going to be elsewhere. Maybe, you know, back then it was how many clicks did you have or how many downloads would you have or other sort of, you know, I don't call them false metrics, but sort of other metrics that don't correlate to, you know, profit and revenue, if you will. But as, you know, as the fad sort of goes a bit through a bit of an arc, eventually it gets to the point where, okay, well, this is great that you have this many likes or this many users or this many clicks or this many logins or downloads or all those other things. But really, are you profitable? And if not, what's your path to profitability and how, what's the likelihood that you're going to get there? And then are, you know, what is your revenue projection? And so it was earlier in my career, like everybody else, I sort of drove a company or drove a team to go chase whatever the fad of the moment was, only to find out eventually it came down to sort of the dollars and cents, if you will. And so that's something that in retrospect, I would have handled a few situations differently earlier in my career, that's the benefit of hindsight and being and having some gray hair.
And how do you see that played with? I mean, I understand what you say, that we need to be more pragmatic. And by experience and having more experience, we have a better idea how pragmatic we should be and how to be pragmatic and look at the right metrics to understand how real this is, if this idea and business and product connected with market and really address a good need and those kind of things. But at the same time, many of these startups, when I look at, they started for something and they ended up something else. And if they didn't have that flexibility in the first year or two to really, you know, be a little bit, to me, I don't know what is the right word, but be a little bit naive on that, or be a little bit adventurous, or be a little bit of kind of, hey, let's just go there and just get it done, and be a little bit more optimistic than they should have been. And then they go and start something, and that leads them to really a great place. And some of the most successful companies are the ones that when they started, the initial idea didn't have that kind of merit. But then they started, you know, playing. And again, it goes back to the right team, looking at the market, adapting the right strategy, and then getting somewhere really great. Now, if every company starts to be very pragmatic from day one, aren't we killing those opportunities? So what is the right level to really go and encourage entrepreneurs and founders to be very pragmatic from day one, versus letting them just be a little bit kind of maybe dreamy at the beginning and adventurous and too optimistic?
Yeah, that, I mean, you make a great point that it comes down to passion and conviction, I believe. If you have passion and conviction around your path or your concept or your idea, well, that can persevere you through, you know, some of these earlier stages like we talked about. I think the point is to follow the passion and your instinct and not be sort of sidetracked by whatever sort of the flavor of the day is in the market, right? So, because that's where I think you do get off track, is instead of worrying about what is your core conviction and staying true to your core conviction and your passion, you read or hear about, well, all of a sudden today, this is the popular thing. And so I don't have enough of those. I'm going to go focus on that. And that's where you can sort of zigzag and sort of chase, if you will. So I think it's really the combination of having the passion and the conviction to sort of stay the course. And eventually, as that plays out, then you can move to the more pragmatic side of the equation, which is, like we mentioned earlier, what is your path to profitability and your revenue growth? But yeah, if on day one you were worried about path to profitability and revenue growth, many of the great companies that we see today probably would have never have gotten off the ground, because that was pretty far out in the future. So it's really a great point that you make there.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I think you said consistent. So that reminds me of another topic that is important here and relevant to the discussion. I lived on the East Coast for 24 years in DC area, and then I moved to the Bay Area and lived in San Francisco Bay Area for some years there. And then now I'm in the middle, very recently moved to Austin, Texas. So I have seen something in the East Coast that people are really more kind of, you know, going back to that old story of the rabbit versus, you know, the turtle, you know, who's going to win the race. And there are different philosophies around that, that sometimes you may feel like what I have seen more on the East Coast of the United States, that most companies and majority of investors, maybe they have a different timeline in mind and you have more time to really get there. And companies that are very successful by their measure can buy a lot of years to get there, versus on the West Coast, everything is more about really a speed. So if you are a company that you have spent 10 years and still you are building foundation, by most of people's measure over there, probably that's not a good kind of, you know, timeline. And you should have already, you know, been somewhere else, and they are pushing you to move faster to get there. And most investors, so more faster versus, you know, something that you do consistently and constantly and persistently and get there. I'm personally myself in the kind of that kind of entrepreneur that I wanted to build this foundation first before I go to market and talk to customers. I'm very, very scared of really being in the market, almost like you are in the war and you're in the battle, but you don't have really any weapon in your hand and you're just on the front line. I'm scared. I'm not a brave person, soldier from that perspective. I just wanted to make sure the product that supports me is very strong when I get there and just in front of, you know, the customer. So it takes more time to build that foundation from people, from team perspective, from product perspective, from process perspective. I'm not advocating really go and just be quick to get there and rush it. But I know the rationale behind really why that timeline needs to be shortened, because it takes time, money, everything, resources. So I get it. It's not like I'm just, you know, let's say just spend time for no good reason. What is your take on it based on your experience, and especially because you have great experience on the sales front and you have been there with these companies? Would you advise a SaaS company, a founder, to really go as fast as you can and just start selling as quickly as you can? Or you have to really build that foundation. It takes time and you should expect that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. And I think the answer is somewhat situational. I think if you're in a certain space and you have conviction about the space, but you also see that others are in the same space and you literally are in a race, if you will, or in that dynamic, you probably have to move more quickly and probably be outside of your comfort zone. I'm probably more similar to you. I'm a slow and steady wins the race kind of guy. There's a reason why I'm not a serial entrepreneur, because I'm not as brave as those folks are, frankly. So there's going to be situations where being fast and sort of being quick to market and quick to act and sort of being outside of your comfort zone, which you can be if you're moving that quickly, I think it can be appropriate. Other times it's probably not appropriate. I think from a selling perspective and with clients, again, that also can be situational. What's the nature of the solution that you're providing? You know, how bad can things get for the client if things go poorly? You know, there's certain areas of technology where a client's risk profile or their threshold is going to be different depending on what you are doing. And so in some cases, they won't be able to afford to take the risk, if you will. In other cases, they will. And so I think there is some situational aspects to this. I remember in early 2000s, I was at a small firm that was in the ASP space before there was even cloud, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we were, as funny as it sounds, we were trying to convince large organizations to actually move their enterprise applications out of their own data centers into our data center. And clients were so resistant and so reluctant. We used to do data center tours, and we would actually they would actually need to go see the diesel generator back up, and would actually ask us to turn it on to make sure it worked, and all this crazy stuff that was about, it was about their risk profile and their risk threshold. And this probably is because these were their enterprise applications. And if those applications went down, the business would shut down. So even though it was an innovative idea that produced a tremendous amount of value, their risk threshold was pretty low. And so they would literally go out and visit these data centers and look at them and check the diesel generators and check the backups and check the security and all this stuff, because their risk threshold was really high or low, depending on how you looked at it. So I think it's very situational, but I do think as a leader, you need to sort of read the room and read the situation, and where you, and you can't be the turtle if the situation requires you to be the rabbit, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't want to be the rabbit when the situation should be the turtle. I think it's really getting that alignment and matching the situation with the action. I think that's the trick, and that's the part that it's key to get right.
Yeah, it never gets, doesn't matter how many times you start a company, it never gets to the point that you say, it's boring, now I know what to do. So,
yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Every single time is different. I need to ask you also a question about the sales versus marketing. That's really something that SaaS companies you know, think about it. Some companies really emphasize a lot on the kind of marketing aspect, and then some really go and invest more to build the right sales organization. And of course, any SaaS company has limited resources. So if they had both options, of course, everyone would have chosen that option to really boost both parts. But there are some cases that you have to choose. If you wanted to really push more toward a marketing based model for your sales organization that is more toward lead gen coming, and then it's more inside sales and it's more really based on the number of leads and the demand level that you generate, sales then take it and close the deals, or you should really go to the other side and then start relying less on the demand and more on the sales that initiate those kind of opportunities by themselves rather than relying 100%. I understand there is no situation that is just black and white. There are a lot of gray area. There are many different things that decide which one works best. And they're not mutually exclusive, to be honest with you. In one company, you can entertain both. But what's your take on it based on your experience?
Yeah, so I'm a kind of an old school, you know, salesperson, if you will. So you could guess kind of where my natural preference or tendency would be. You know, having said that, you know, there's a lot of factors right now that are changing this whole area, you know, ranging from us spending several years in the pandemic where you didn't travel. So even sales that may have been more traditionally done in person were done remotely, and people realized actually that we don't need to travel as maybe as much as we used to, which is kind of what video conferencing used to tell us 5, 6, 8, 10 years ago, and we never would buy into it, and now we're all into it, if you will. And then you also have the sort of the changing sort of demographic, if you will, as people like in my age sort of start retiring out of the business and replaced by folks that are younger who are not predisposed to getting on planes and doing the travel, frankly. And so they're more accustomed to sort of working remotely. That's going to change the nature of things as well. So those, you know, those two trends would tell you that you could do more virtual selling, if you will. On the other side, the mark in the digital and social sort of marketing that's happening is so pervasive, and it's almost dilutive. It's everywhere. And I couldn't tell you how many emails that I get either through my personal email or my company email. And it's to the point where anybody's listening, do not email me because I don't read them. It's just too many. And actually, you know, every once in a while, a salesperson will get through to me. And I'm sensitive to that because I used to be that person 25 years ago. And so I'll try to listen, but anyway, it's just so much volume and it's so much noise that it's almost to the point where I don't think it's effective. And so that would tell you that you're going to have to almost go back to sort of the old-fashioned way, if you will, which is to get on a plane and go meet with people. And so I could sort of see two trends, you know, that are sort of opposed to each other, if you will. And I think, again, it becomes sort of situational. And I mean, ultimately, selling is about getting someone to sort of make this leap of faith towards your solution, right? So if I'm going to ask you to sort of, you know, give me your funds, if you will, and in return, we're going to give this solution. Ultimately, there's a leap of faith the buyer has to take. Mm-hmm. And basically, your job in sales is to make that leap of faith as short of a step as possible. Right. So instead of a leap, just make it a step, if you will. And so depending on what you're selling and what kind of pain point you're addressing for your client, and again, how bad can things go if it goes bad for the client? I think that does have an impact here. You know, there's certain solutions that you would buy that are maybe on the commodity base, frankly, where you're not going to meet with people for that. Other solutions that you would never buy that without having multiple meetings in person. So there is some situational aspect, but I still sort of lean on relationship selling. I think relationships matter. I think looking someone in the eye, whether it's directly or remotely, matters. And there's a whole sort of segment of the market or the industry where I think you're going to have to continue to sort of build relationships and sell via relationships. And I think where you have relationships and where you're effective in building those relationships, is going to help separate you from all the noise that's out there, because the digital marketing and digital selling machine is super powerful. It's quite pervasive, and it's almost gotten to the point that I think it's drowning everything out. It's just too much. I think I don't know how effective it is, frankly.
Understood. Lee, I would like to ask you also at this point to introduce or share with us a book that either you personally liked it or you professionally liked it, and it changed in a good way, you know, the way you do things. So that would be great to hear from you on that.
Yeah, there's a couple of books that come to mind, but I guess the first one that I think about a lot was a book called Necessary But Not Sufficient, written by Ellie Goldratt, if I got his name correct. I'd have to look it up. And I read that probably in 2002-03, somewhere in there. And it's really about constraints, and it really is about sort of understanding not just the issue at a surface level, but actually going deeper into the issue and understanding that the problem that you're seeing here is actually tied to something that's happening way over there. And, you know, a more recent book that kind of built on that was The Phoenix Project, same kind of concept applied to IT, if you will. And it really, it's a concept that has sort of really stuck with me and that I've leveraged and used quite a bit, which is not to just, you know, look at an issue at the surface, but actually kind of get up on the balcony, if you can say it that way, and look around and actually try to understand what is happening. What are the chain of events that's creating this problem that you're addressed? And oftentimes the solution to the problem isn't the one that's right in front of you, but it's actually making an adjustment somewhere over here. And then the ripple effect of that adjustment will solve the problem that's right in front of you. So that sort of thinking and concept is something that really resonated with me when I first read and learned it. And it's something that definitely has stuck with me to this day.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for sharing it. It was great speaking with you, Leah. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a fantastic discussion. I really, really do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Arman Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to saasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution for SaaS companies on AWS. The tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.